This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
What I'm going to present today is less a finished paper than a kind of sketch or outline of a project to come. It concerns the transmission of political acts, or how the transformative potential of an act can be preserved, sustained, or transmitted, not only over time, but across national and geographic boundaries. David Scott has recently taken up a related problem in Omens of Adversity, questioning the staying power of great revolutionary programs and whether they are able to retain their vitality and promise over time. In a critical reading of C.L.R. James's The Black Jacobins, he questions James's confidence in the ability of this great slave uprising to function as a model for international Marxism and for Black Caribbean emancipation in particular. For Scott, the emancipatory program James is attempting to isolate and transmit is no longer of its time, but what he calls a future past, a future that has lapsed, a dream whose day never came, and that no longer holds any promise for the present. The question I would like to pursue here is a different one. It concerns the transformative potential not of an agenda or a program, but of an act. The act, as I understand it, differs not only from an agenda or a platform, but from the kinds of acts that political theory generally takes as its object, since it is neither a sovereign act, for example, a legislative act or a sovereign decision, nor a popular action, for example, a collective action or general strike, a coup d'etat, an act of regicide. More than transmitting a program or formulating a reality or state of affairs it brings into being, the act as I'm conceiving it is something that acts upon us, that leaves impressions or traces, that strikes us whether or not we recognize it, understand it, or accept it. It's this dimension of the act that I think Scott misses in James' reading of Toussaint Louverture and the San Domingo Slave Rebellion, which will be the subject of my paper today. But before turning to James, I want to explore this problematic by way of a second book, not coincidentally published in the same year, which is also concerned with a failed movement and the uncertain transmission of an act, Freud's Moses of Monotheism. Both books are in many ways about the successes and failures of two specific men, Toussaint Louverture and Moses, and their inability to impose in a durable way what they sought to transmit. Far from contesting the success of the act, however, these failures may actually be intrinsic to the act and its real efficacy. Freud's reading of Moses allows us to appreciate the difference between an agenda and an act. It addresses what might be called the unconscious legacy of an act, which exceeds the frame of interpretation, embrace, or allegiance. My hypothesis is that it might shed some light on one of the fundamental questions of political theory, what Rousseau in The Social Contract calls the act by which a people is a people. A people is not, first of all, a collection of persons or a demographic that subsequently expresses its will. Instead, it comes into being through an act. For Rousseau, the act is not primarily something that a people does, therefore, but something that makes a people that is then capable of willing and doing. Freud identifies such an act in the story of the biblical Moses and the Exodus from Egypt, which he understands as a founding or enactment of a people. In this, he's not alone, of course. But Freud takes a people presumed to have been founded in one way, by divine election, and then shows it to have been constituted in an entirely different way than the national myth would have us believe. What is striking about Moses and monotheism, as you know, is the strange, indirect, and circuitous process reconstructed by Freud, in which the Israelites come to be a people by finding themselves the unintended and accidental heirs of an act that was never addressed to them, that they didn't want, and that they even fought very hard to unburden themselves of. The Bible tells us that the chosen people was constituted long before Moses comes along in the covenant God makes with the patriarch Abraham. Moses is introduced as a member of that people, a child born into slavery in Egypt, who washes up on the shores of the Nile and is adopted by the Pharaoh as his own son, before becoming the outspoken prophet of national liberation that we know from myth and legend. For Freud, however, the notion that the Hebrew people were chosen by God is absurd, an obvious distortion. The myth of Israel's divine election can only be explained as a displaced recognition of the fact that Moses chose the Israelites to be his people. Moses was not of that people, moreover, but an educated Egyptian who was the bearer of an entirely different cultural legacy. He chose the Hebrew people to be the inheritors and guardians of a religion they neither originated nor chose, but had imposed on them by this inspired foreigner, who was as visionary and ingenious as he was intolerant and irascible. This is not a matter of slaves emancipating themselves, or even of a beneficent God freeing his people from oppression, but of an elite exile from an imperial kingdom amassing the foot soldiers who will carry out his own grand design. But wait, we still haven't heard the last of it. The grand scheme doesn't even originate with Moses himself, but with the Pharaoh in whose court he first learned of the grand project and dedicated his life to it. The founding of the Jews as a people begins not with Abraham, therefore, or even with Moses, but with the Pharaoh Akhenaten. It is Akhenaten who originates the monotheism that history will ascribe to the Jews as their proudest legacy, when, by a sovereign command, he substitutes the worship of Aton, a divine being whose energy was manifested in the rays of the sun, for the hundreds of deities whose cults had dominated Egyptian religion for 2,000 years. Freud describes Akhenaten as the first individual in human history, the first actor. But we know how the story goes. When Akhenaten invented monotheism, he couldn't make it stick. He had too much of the dreamer about him, too little of the leader. After his death, the royal city is abandoned, its temples desecrated, and its stelae destroyed, and the worship of the one and only God is eliminated virtually overnight from the land of Egypt. Even the name of Aton will disappear, stricken from the pharaoh's self-given epithet and from the names of his children. Akhenaten will be buried as he was born, as Amenhotep IV. The traces of the subject, of the individual he became, will be erased from the religion and the national narrative of Egypt. Now it is Moses, most likely a trusted member of Akhenaten's inner circle, who will take up the baton and attempt to realize the precious dream. In this hour of need, writes Freud, Moses found an unusual solution. The dreamer Akhenaten had estranged himself from his people and let his world empire crumble. Moses' active nature conceived the plan of founding a new empire, of finding a new people to whom he could give the religion that Egypt disdained. It was, as we perceive, a heroic attempt to struggle against his fate, to find compensation in two directions for the losses he had suffered through Akhenaten's catastrophe. Perhaps he was at that time governor of that border province in which certain Semitic tribes had settled. These he chose to be his new people, a historic decision. In full contradistinction to the biblical tradition, we may suppose this exodus to have passed off peacefully and without pursuit. The authority of Moses made it possible, and there was then no central power that could have prevented it, unquote. Moses attempts to make a people, and this founding will is remarkable, extraordinary, and unprecedented in human history. But it is also doomed to failure. In the institutional speak of today, he has no buy-in from his constituents. The Mosaic innovation fails to catch on with the broad mass of the Hebraic people, who never completely overcome the superstitions and hostilities of the totemic mind. The episode of the golden calf encodes the people's falling away from the new religion and demand for new father substitutes. By an adroit turn, the breaking of the tables of the law, which Freud understands symbolically, he has broken the law, is ascribed to Moses himself, who is hated and reviled as a criminal. Finally, the man Freud describes as an enlightened despot meets a violent end in a rebellion of his stubborn and refractory people, and the religion he instituted is abandoned. The Jews ultimately owe their founding as a people neither to their own initiative nor even to the leadership of Moses, therefore, but to the act of Akhenaten, an Egyptian who probably never gave so much as a thought to the Hebrew slaves toiling in his kingdom, and who would later receive no credit for that founding in the religion and the national myths of Israel. Even the act of Moses will be lost, this time not by simple erasure, but through the distortions introduced and sustained by the biblical myth itself. After his death, Moses is deified as a stern and demanding god, his traits and actions attributed to a fearsome volcano deity whose worship had preceded the monotheist innovation, and who better satisfies the popular imaginary. The acts of the man Moses and the subject that engendered them are thus effaced by the very legend that immortalizes them as supernatural feats. We have then two dead actors, two suppressed acts, and two restorations. And yet the act doesn't die there, but continues to make its way through history and to stamp the subject it strikes with its unique imprint. The founding acts of Moses and Akhenaten do not disappear with their deaths, but are sustained and nurtured by a select few, most likely educated members of the priestly class, who keep the legacy alive at great risk to themselves, perhaps over a span of several centuries. Eventually, the doctrine of monotheism flourishes again and becomes the lasting legacy of the Jews, one they did not actually create, in Freud's view, but for which they are nonetheless justified in feeling tremendous pride. This is because they kept it alive, nurtured it, and transmitted it to future generations so that it might become the enduring institution we know today. Finally, the Jews really do come together as a people and assume as their mantle the legacy that under Moses they experienced only as a yoke. The Mosaic transmission does not stop there, moreover, but becomes with time a legacy that will jump the bounds of that people, that will flourish beyond the confines of Jewish ritual practice and the monotheist religions more broadly. In the guiding principles of Western jurisprudence, in moral and aesthetic philosophy, and in the struggles of New World slaves for their freedom, and even in the invention of psychoanalysis itself. Elsewhere, I've argued that if Freud is one of Moses' people, it's not primarily because he was a Jew, but because he was a psychoanalyst. Yeah. What I want to stress in this reconstruction is the kind of relay race Freud identifies, in which one subject or one people passes the baton to another, not in a straight linear transmission, but by means of a series of individual acts. In each case, the legacy is sustained by someone who is struck by the act and moved to take up the baton. What he or she takes up is not even necessarily of the order of a program or project, as in the example of monotheism, but a real kernel that resists easy codification or translation. Freud describes the act as leaving a stamp, a kind of impression or inscription. How, he asks of Moses, did one single man come to stamp his people with its definite character and determine its fate for millennia to come? We need to distinguish two elements in this transmission, which might be described alternately as symbolic and real, conscious and unconscious. The Israelite priests remember and sustain something that is of the order of an articulated program, the rational, ethical core of monotheism. But what is not transmitted by that tradition is the role of Moses himself, the subject of the act, whose traits are folded into that of the God who is falsely credited with liberating the Hebrews from slavery. Even more important, the narrative represses the murder of the man Moses by the very people he led to safety and a new life. That the transmission of his act and the stamp it left on his people is thus inseparable from its repression, its necessary flip side. How then do we know of it? Through the Apostle Paul, who retains unconsciously what the distortions of the legendary narrative have condemned to forgetting. Paul's unconscious knows what generations of Hebrews have managed to forget, at least consciously, the truth of the primal murder and its repetition on the person of Moses. So it's crucial for Freud's reading that the repressed is not something that can be found in a text, right, in an archaeological artifact, or even in an oral tradition. It's found in the speech of a subject, a speech that supposes a body. Right? So the image of the stamp that Moses leaves on his people implies a kind of corporeal impression, right? A body that receives an imprint, a mark, or a blow. So part of what I'm thinking about here is Freud's short piece, The Note on the Mystic Writing Pad, right, where he attempts to think about the unconscious and its relation to conscious memory and how a trace or an impression is received that leaves no mark in consciousness. Nonetheless, to say that the body is involved in a central way does not mean this is about presence or even about a spontaneous lived experience. The baton metaphor I have just offered to evoke its transmission is inexact on at least two levels. First, it imputes to the act a telos or an objective it may not have, for example, evoking a race that has many different runners but a single goal or finish line. And second, it supposes two or more runners who are present in the same historical space-time. But what is remarkable about the act, as Freud suggests, is that it doesn't require this kind of contiguity. Its transmission is non-linear, non-continuous, sometimes skipping many generations and crossing continents, but imposing itself nonetheless. So the act has almost this sort of drive-by quality, you know, of striking or hitting someone who simply finds themselves in the line of fire accidentally, right? It is this intersubjective and trans-historical dimension of the act and the consequences of the stamp or impression it leaves that I want to begin to explore today. Freud helps us to see that the difference between a mere group or collectivity and a people, properly speaking, the people as the subject of its own destiny, is that a group becomes a people only by assuming an act. Or, to put it another way, a people is founded by an act whereas a group is structured by its refusal. This working definition might in turn allow us to distinguish between a true act, the act of a subject, and the mechanisms of the group psychology that work to indefinitely defer the necessity of the act, to refuse its lack of guarantee, or to silence or negate the act of the leader or founder and the anxiety it provokes. What Freud calls acting in the place of remembering in the case of the Hebrews' murder of Moses. In a recent book, I began to think about these problems by exploring how the subjective stance of one person can initiate broad change or inspire collective action by means other than the group psychology. In other words, not by appealing to a particular set of values or ideals, or by cementing the group through identification, but by foregrounding the desire of the subject and the dimension of the act. My approach was inspired in part by Peter Hallward's recent work on political will, which deals with a number of historical figures whose examples have galvanized popular movements and the slogans that condense their exemplarity. What would Jesus do in the context of the liberation theology so influential in Latin America, but also what would Mao do, what would Robespierre do, and so forth. In these examples, I was intrigued by the relationship between the individual act and the people who receive and bear witness to it, or the notion that the ethical stance or subjective position of an individual might incite a change of position in other people. And interesting, if you're following any of Peter's work on will, he's kind of totally abandoned that perspective, which I think was very rich, and instead is much more concerned with ideals, you know, as a telos of a revolutionary program. I argue that the psychoanalytic mechanism of the transference makes a novel contribution to this question by demonstrating that only the desire of the other can solicit the unconscious and so provoke a shift in the subject's position. This is why analysis requires two people. Where the analysand is concerned, repression stands in the way of change. His position is determined by a not wanting to know anything about it that precludes any examination of the fantasy structuring his symptoms and his relations with others. The desire of a second subject, a desire to know about what causes the subject, is necessary to solicit the response of the unconscious in the form of signifiers attesting to another knowledge about the subject's encounter with the real of the drives. Psychoanalysis can in this sense be understood as a form of social tie, but one that opposes the symbolic articulation of desire and castration to the imaginary mechanisms of identification and seduction. Psychoanalyst Willy Apollon describes the transference that inaugurates the analytic experience as a minimal social link in which analysand and analyst are bound not by love or identification, but by the desire of the analyst that solicits a response from the subject's unconscious. The logic of the transference reveals that under certain conditions, the desire of one subject can have the effect of liberating another subject's desire and allowing it to find expression in an act. It shows that the singular act of a subject may respond to the act of another person without necessarily taking it as a model or an ideal. Jacques Lacan writes that the fundamental question of psychoanalysis is, quote, how to operate honestly with desire, how to preserve desire in the act. Ordinarily, the act is the extinction rather than the realization of desire, or at best, nothing more than its exploit or heroic gesture. How then can we preserve a simple relation between desire and this act? Unquote. The murder of Moses is an example of an act that extinguishes desire, but so arguably is any act that finds its value merely in the affirmation of an ideal. Here I want to begin exploring these questions through an example that is more explicitly political. James's account of the dynamic and dialectical interplay between the French and Haitian revolutions in the Black Jacobins. And as I continue to work on this paper, I want to give more thought to the parallels between the Black Jacobins and Moses and monotheism, which were not only written in the same year, 1938, but both appeal to a distant past from the perspective of a very specific present, the Spanish Civil War in James's case, and the rise of National Socialism and the annexation of Austria in Freud's. So recall that he begins the book in occupied Vienna, but then finishes it in exile in London after being targeted by the Nazis for promoting the Jewish science. In both cases, I'm interested in thinking about what James and Freud are seeking to renew or reactivate in the historical events they reconstruct. For David Scott, James would be looking for a lesson for the present, a way forward that takes inspiration from the past. And yet this is also a failure, not only for James himself, as he looks back on this argument in the preface to the 1963 edition, but also for Scott, thinking about the challenges facing the Caribbean today, many years after decolonization. These are unavoidable problems, and I don't mean to diminish them or pretend to have a solution. But I do want to suggest that more is going on in James's and Freud's glances to the past, both of which take the form of constructions or reenactments of a subjective experience, and not merely the study of one element or another of the historical event, than the recuperation of a model or a lesson for the present. What they show is that while agendas and solutions may grow dated or cease to be relevant to new circumstances, the act is not something that expires or shows its age. This is because the act is neither solely of its time, and therefore marked with a specific expiration date, nor truly timeless, but rather inherently untimely, whence its scandalous, unprecedented, and even illegal character, which is different from its actuality or relevance. The problem of the act is also too readily collapsed into that of the great man or epic personality, on which Freud and James both place so much emphasis, often to the ridicule of their critics. But it is the act that both really highlight, and thus the problem of the subject, much more than the charismatic personality or man of genius. Ultimately, I want to think about this in terms of two different lines of transmission. First, David Scott reading James on the legacy of Toussaint, himself interpreting Robespierre and the Jacobins, where the question is the possibility of post-colonial political emancipation. And second, Derrida's reading of Yerushalmi, reading Freud on the Apostle Paul, in whose unconscious Freud finds the traces of the murder of Moses, and through it, the legacy of Akhenaten. There, the problem is the legacy of Judaism and Jewish chosenness and its supposed betrayal by Freud, right? But since this idea only came to me late last night, I'm not going to attempt that reading here. Today, I'm going to focus on something more specific, the concern implied in James's title. What interests me in the formula, the Black Jacobins, is not only the well-known contrapuntal structure of James's text and the complex lines of influence he identifies between the French Revolution and the Haitian War of Independence, but a gesture that recalls, in many respects, Freud's own in Moses and Monotheism. Like the Egyptian Moses, the Black Jacobins is a construction or reconstruction that fundamentally changes the stakes of a specific national or popular legacy by speaking to its potential for a transnational or transhistorical transmission. James's book brings in a second important frame, that of what Rousseau calls the general will in its relation to the act. Recall that for Rousseau, like Freud, a people is not first of all a collection of persons or a demographic that subsequently expresses its will. Instead, it comes into being through an act. Like the subject of the unconscious, which cannot be represented on the social stage, but manifests itself only in rare, episodic, and discontinuous instances of speech, the people eludes representation and expresses itself solely through the acts that make known its will. This point is crucial to Rousseau's concept of the general will, which attempts to think the general or collective will neither as the mere aggregate or count of individual wills, nor as a kind of mind meld or herd mentality, but as a will that is united and one without necessarily implying a majority view or consensus, much less a unanimity of opinion. This is because it identifies the people as a subject or actor above and beyond the individual persons who make up a society or a group. The problem of the general will would seem to be a logical place to explore the trans-individual nature of the act. However, it seems to me that readings of the general will generally do not place too much emphasis on the act. Instead, they tend to emphasize the tension between private interests and the general good, or the negotiation of their interface. Trans-individual, in this context, often means hostile to private interest or negating of the individual. Here, the famous words of Robespierre would be exemplary. Il nous faut une volonté une, right? We need one will, a will in which personal or private interest has no place. The flip side of this radical depersonalization of the general will is a tendency to identify the problematic of the act with the agency of a sovereign or leader and the related problematics of decision, command, and performative declaration. Although I can't claim to have an exhaustive knowledge of the literature, it seems to me that the dimension of the act is very often downplayed or marginalized in radical leftist readings of the general will and taken up in much more detail by the right. We can think here of the centrality of the act to Schmitt's account of sovereignty as a decision on the exception, an argument that justifiably occupies a central place on the political literature of the act, but by no means exhausts its scope. This may explain in part why interpretations of the general will from a radical left perspective often seem to oppose the general will to the act, identifying the former with the will of the people and the common good, and the latter with a rogue individualism whose deist or dictatorial overtones invariably come to the fore. Hence the familiar theme of the leader brought down by his tyranny or his hubris, executed or imprisoned for having put himself above the people. Robespierre falling victim to the terror he instigated in what is either a well-deserved comeuppance or a tragic betrayal, depending on your perspective, but also the tragic reading of Toussaint as a heroic revolutionary who devolves into a merciless dictator. Slavoj Žižek departs from the common take on Robespierre as a kind of traitor of the revolution, arguing that the great Jacobin actually epitomizes the stakes of the general will. This is not because he exposes its dictatorial or totalitarian overtones, but because he does not claim to have direct access to the people's will, unlike the totalitarian leader, who supposes that the people really exist and that the leader or party can therefore substantialize its will. Reading a notorious speech in which Robespierre tells his audience that those who are free of guilt have nothing to fear from the terror, Žižek suggests that guilt here consists precisely in the presumption that one is innocent, or the posture that consists in detaching oneself from the general will, here the terror itself, or pretending to be an innocent bystander. One is guilty not of specific deeds, therefore, as under a regime of law, but of refusing the general will itself, which by definition is always right. Robespierre, in contrast, does not pretend to be more pure than those he accuses, but instead affirms his readiness to die in turn if his actions should come into conflict with the general will. Nevertheless, Žižek's reading arguably entails the same priority of the general will over the act by proposing that the act is ultimately submitted to the judgment or approbation of the general will and is deemed legitimate or illegitimate, successful or a failure, only to the extent that it manages to make manifest that will. The general will is primary, therefore, and the act is either its possible crystallization or its betrayal. Even the greatest of revolutionaries must disappear to make way for the people, a people that transcends its embodiment in the individual actors who are always at risk of being named enemies of the people. This logic may help to explain why the great actors and agents of revolutionary change, from Akhenaten and Moses to Robespierre and Trotsky, are so often the victims of the very movements to which they gave rise. Hannah Arendt famously takes a dim view of the implied criminalization of the act and what she calls the peculiar selflessness of the revolutionists, which should not be confused with idealism or heroism. For Robespierre in particular, she writes, quote, "Virtue meant to identify one's will with the will of the people, whence the conviction that the value of a policy may be gauged by the extent to which it will contradict all personal interests, the value of a man determined by his acting against his will." Unquote. She notes that for Rousseau, the very existence of the general will hinges upon its being opposed to each interest or will in particular. The construction of this many-headed one is thus predicated upon the unifying power of a common enemy, the foreign enemy that unites the nation against it, but also the enemy within the breast of each citizen, his particular will. The common enemy within the nation is therefore the sum total of the particular interests of all citizens. Hence, it is not surprising, she writes, that the theory of terror from Robespierre to Lenin and Stalin presupposes that the interest of the whole must automatically and indeed permanently be hostile to the particular interest of the citizen. But although Arendt is critical of the way in which individual will is discredited and criminalized, she too is arguably hostile to the logic of the act, whose despotic character continues to inflect the popular will, even after it has discredited and purged any notion of individual selfhood. Hence her notorious claim that the general will is just autocratic rule by another name. It is no accident that the French people, who under the Ancien Régime had known no other form of rule than absolute monarchy, should have experienced a revolution that was equally absolute in character, admitting of no division or equivocation in the nation's will and brooking no dissent. We find a second, even more damning repudiation of the act in Arendt's distinction between the French and American revolutions, where she praises the latter for circumscribing the will or limiting the legitimacy of the popular act, whose vital but always destabilizing constituent power she opposes to the durability of the Constitution as the source of law. The only legitimate act, she suggests, is an act that results in a new constitution, a new founding, and therefore an order of law that obviates further need for recourse to the act in its constituent power. So I'm just realizing that that long digression may not have been necessary, but whatever. I want to propose that the trans-individual, trans-historical transmission of the act that we see elaborated in both Freud and James offers another way of thinking about the general will, one that doesn't simply oppose the individual and the collective. I see it in a remarkable passage from the Black Jacobins, where James evokes this inner subjective dimension of the act and the general will in strikingly suggestive terms. The passage is central to the argument that structures most of the book, which concerns the relations of mutual causality between the French Revolution and the San Domingo slave rebellion, the prologue to the Haitian Revolution that erupted less than a year later. In James's reading, the slave rebellion is not only influenced and inspired by revolutionary developments in France, but directly responsible for the radical populist turn that the French Revolution took in 1793. Breaking with its origin as a primarily bourgeois revolt driven by commercial interests. As the title suggests, he ties the acts of the revolting Haitian slaves to the political philosophy of the Jacobin Club, not as its derivative or copy, but as its ultimate realization and fruition. It is thus the intersubjective dimension of the act, more than influence or context, that structures James's argument. Before turning to the passage itself, let me first describe how James sets the stage. In the waning months of 1789, as the forces of reaction were already triumphing in France and the radicals in the Jacobin Club were just beginning to concentrate their forces, James describes how the slaves in France's distant colony, hearing for the first time the Declaration of the Rights of Man, perceive the profound truth of universal emancipation and revolt against their masters. This is true not only of Toussaint, a true student of the revolution who follows its developments closely from afar, but of the enslaved masses more broadly, who grasp its import immediately without the benefit of education or political knowledge. In James's words, quote, they had heard of the revolution and had construed it in their own image. The white slaves in France had risen and killed their masters and were now enjoying the fruits of the earth. It was gravely inaccurate, in fact, but they had caught the spirit of the thing. Liberty, equality, fraternity, unquote. Before the end of 1789, there were uprisings all over San Domingo, as well as in the nearby slaveholding colonies of Guadeloupe and Martinique. James describes the Haitians as being struck spontaneously and viscerally by something within the Declaration of the Rights of Man that was not experienced or understood in the same manner by the Frenchmen who were its immediate audience, or for that matter, by its authors. They understood its freedom and equality in much narrower terms, for example, as a freedom to do business without excessive taxation, or as a political equality that nonetheless distinguished so-called active citizens from their passive and non-voting counterparts, women, slaves, and men without property. James's remarkable claim is that the slaves felt themselves interpolated or called forth as a people by words that were never meant for them, by authors who did not mean to address them, and who even had a vested interest in their continued enslavement. Earlier, I described the drive-by quality of the act, its capacity to strike a person or a people who may simply be caught in the crossfire. James identifies the flip side of the same problematic, the way in which the act can strike a body, or in this case, many bodies, that its author never intended to emancipate. San Domingo, in James's reading, is not merely an audience for the French Revolution or its emerging ideals, therefore, but the site where the truth of universal emancipation actually appears for the first time and ceases to have a narrow or purely local meaning. The revolting slaves not only receive and register for the first time the message of universal emancipation, but in turn transmit it through their act of claiming their own equality to the French masses, the poor, le peuple, who Robespierre idealizes as the heart and soul of the Republic, but who are not yet politicized in their own right. Thus, for James, it is the enslaved subjects of San Domingo who actually start the revolution, which the Parisian masses take up and complete. But at least there might be a promise of pardon, of kind treatment in the future. No, not a word. Neither from Vaublanc on the right, nor Robespierre on the left. Robespierre made an ass of himself by violently objecting to the word slavery when it was proposed as a substitute for the non-free. Brissot made a passing reference to them as being unfortunate, and that was all. The friends of the Negro, good liberals, were now in power and were as silent about slavery as any colonist. The slaves, ignorant of politics, had been right not to wait on these eloquent phrase makers. Toussaint, that astute student of French politics, read and noted, unquote. So, I mean, it's interesting already that the Robespierre that James describes has nothing to do with most of the literature on the French Revolution, right? Because it's not Robespierre who crystallizes for him the stakes of the general will. Ultimately, it is the French people and not their representatives who act in solidarity with their brothers in the colonies. James documents the direct and profound effect that the news of the slave revolts has upon the Parisian masses, who not only sympathize with the plight of the slaves, but see in it a reflection of their own state. Quote, servants, peasants, workers, the laborers by day in the fields all over France were filled with a virulent hatred against the aristocracy of the skin. There were many so moved by the sufferings of the slaves that they had long ceased to drink coffee, thinking of it as drenched with the blood and sweat of men turned into brutes. Unquote. For James, this is not a matter of mere identification or sympathy, however. Instead, he suggests that the masses are literally constituted as a people by their recognition that the plight of the Haitian slaves is their own plight, a quest for a liberty and an equality that must be truly universal to have any meaning. Where the aristocracy of the skin persists, they realize, the principle of aristocracy itself has not been defeated, and there can be no true equality, even among whites. They therefore trump the high-minded intellectuals and religious advocates for abolition, who already had a certain presence in France, by acting to affirm an already existing equality, the fundamental and inalienable equality of all humans as free beings, rather than advancing strategic measures for the improved treatment of the slaves or manifesting an empathetic and somewhat condescending pity for their plight. When the people grow frustrated with the Girondin party, whose concern with protecting bourgeois commercial interests prevents them from taking up the question of abolition, they force its leaders to retire from the convention and place them under house arrest. They then throw their support to the extreme left, Robespierre and the Mountain, contributing to the populist foment leading to the arrest and execution of Louis XVI. But despite the feeling for slaves in France, the convention did nothing for over a year. It is in this context that the passage on your handout appears. This, writes James, was the France to which, in January 1794, three deputies sent by San Domingo to the convention arrived. Belay, a Negro slave who had purchased his freedom, Mills, a mulatto, and Dufay, a white man. Now, the convention is made up of deputies from the bourgeois as well as popular classes. A wide spectrum of political views are represented by its members, some of whom tolerate slavery as a private matter concerning owners and their property, while others favor abolition and the according of full political rights. Yet when the deputies of San Domingo enter the room, James writes that what happened there was quite unpremeditated. The chairman of the Committee on Decrees addressed the convention. Citizens, your Committee on Decrees has verified the credentials of the deputies from San Domingo. It finds them in order, and I move that they be admitted to their places in the convention. Camboulat rose. Since 1789, the aristocracy of birth and the aristocracy of religion have been destroyed, but the aristocracy of skin still remains. That, too, is now at its last gasp, and equality has been consecrated. A black man, a yellow man, are about to join this convention in the name of the free citizens of San Domingo. The three deputies of San Domingo entered the hall. The black face of Belay and the yellow face of Mills excited long and repeated bursts of applause. Lacroix followed. The assembly has been anxious to have within it some of these men of color who have suffered oppression for so many years. Today it has two of them. I demand that their introduction be marked by the president's fraternal embrace. The motion was carried amidst applause. The three deputies of San Domingo advanced to the president and received the fraternal kiss while the hall rang with fresh applause. Next day, Belay, the Negro, delivered a long and fiery oration, pledging the blacks to the cause of the revolution and asking the convention to declare slavery abolished. It was fitting that a Negro and an ex-slave should make the speech which introduced one of the most important legislative acts ever passed by any political assembly. No one spoke after Belay. Instead, Levasseur moved a motion. When drawing up the Constitution of the French people, we paid no attention to the unhappy Negroes. Posterity will bear us great reproach for that. Let us repair the wrong. Let us proclaim the liberty of the Negroes. Mr. President, do not suffer the convention to dishonor itself by a discussion. The assembly rose in acclamation. The two deputies of color appeared on the tribune and embraced while the applause rolled round the hall from members and visitors. Lacroix led the mulatto and the Negro to the president, who gave them the presidential kiss when the applause started again. Cambone drew the attention of the House to an incident which had taken place among the spectators. A citizeness of color who regularly attends the sittings of the convention has just felt so keen a joy at seeing us give liberty to all her brethren that she has fainted. Applause. I demand that this fact be mentioned in the minutes, and that the citizeness be admitted to the sitting and receive at least this much recognition of her civic virtues. The motion was carried, and the woman walked to the front bench of the amphitheater and sat to the left of the president, drying her tears amidst another burst of cheering. Lacroix, who had spoken the day before, then proposed the draft of the decree. I demand that the Minister of Marine be instructed to dispatch at once advices to the colonies to give them the happy news of their freedom, and I propose the following decree. The National Convention declares slavery abolished in all the colonies. In consequence, it declares that all men, without distinction of color, domiciled in the colonies, are French citizens and enjoy all the rights assured under the convention. Gone was all the talking and fumbling, the sabotage of the Barnaves, the convenient memory of the Brissots. And then what's amazing is that this passage is immediately followed by a description of Toussaint receiving news of the decree 3 months later as he sits astride a horse on the battlefield of San Domingo, right, and deciding instantaneously and without hesitation to devote himself to the cause of the revolution. The next day in church, his demeanor is so devout that those present find his face to be both radiant and terrible in its resolve, leading one observer to say that God himself, if he came to earth, could not visit a purer spirit than Toussaint Louverture. So it's a real kind of Moses moment, right, of both Toussaint kind of receiving this transmission, but also his face is burning with this kind of fire that is not necessarily legible, right, but terrifying, right, that acts upon those around him. I read this episode, the one on the handout, not merely as a remarkable scene of emergence of the general will above and beyond personal interests, but as a striking example of what Rousseau describes as the act by which a people becomes a people. In asserting that the convention would be dishonored by a discussion, the delegate who introduces the motion makes clear that even the reasoned deliberation that Arendt so values has no place here. It would only debase the matter by making it a debate about interests and opinions rather than about the fundamental humanity the assembly affirms by acclamation, standing as one body and speaking with one voice that is not mediated by individual votes. The significance of the scene is in no way diminished by the fact that these private interests almost immediately reassert themselves, causing many members of the convention to regret, in fact, the very next day, the momentous decision they have just undertaken by acclamation. When some among them realize, for example, that in affirming the freedom of the black slaves, they've in many cases gone against their own commercial and financial interests. So what's remarkable about James's account is that it's not nearly as romantic or as idealizing as its critics sometimes claim. Right, what happens in the convention is an event, to be sure, but it's not a conversion event. Right? In fact, it might even be understood as a moment of enthusiasm, very much ruled by a state of mind, as Arendt puts it, and not by conscious deliberation. An enthusiasm that quickly dies away, leaving many members of the assembly to seriously regret the momentous action they have just taken. James describes them awaking the next day with a kind of hangover, regretting the excesses of the moment. Quote, the convention, bourgeois itself, was not too happy after the first excitement was over, unquote. Others embraced the decree, but less out of a sense of justice than for tactical reasons. The efficacy of the act does not depend upon its affecting this conversion, however, or even on the elimination of private interests. What is especially striking here is the intersubjective dimension of the act, which is fulfilled or made manifest by the traces it leaves upon others, more than by the embrace of an agenda. Jacques Lacan, in a seminar on the analytic act, suggests that the analysand's act is not something the analyst can know, interpret, or anticipate, but rather something by which he is struck, both psychically and in the body, where it leaves its traces or inscriptions. What strikes the analyst in the act, as distinct from the acting out that often characterizes the analysand's way of relating to the analyst, for example, as an object of love or aggression, is what Lacan calls the objet, right, the object cause of desire that acts in and through the subject. Because the object cause of desire is a purely mental object that does not, properly speaking, exist, it cannot be perceived, sensed, or known empirically. Instead, it must create a path or make room for itself in the world through the subject's act, an act that has consequences for the world or for mankind as a whole, and not simply for the individual subject. What then is involved in being struck by the act of another, and how might it help us to understand the stakes of the act in processes of social or political emancipation? James's example suggests that the body thus struck is the collective body or body politic, the one that rises in acclamation in response to the act of the Haitian delegates. His analysis, like Freud's reading of the legacy of Moses, suggests that the act is at once singular and specific, unique to a given subject, and at the same time transcends the individual subject, having a resonance that exceeds its initial milieu. Both arguments point to what might be called the trans-individual or trans-historical character of the act, its susceptibility to being transmitted and taken up by subsequent generations or in different contexts. The Jewish priests who managed to transmit and keep alive the Mosaic legacy, even after its repression, but also the black slaves of the American Republic who take up the mantle of this emancipatory tradition, as in the Negro spiritual Go Down Moses. The act of the convention is thus further interesting in that it is a response to another act, the act of the Haitian slaves declaring and demanding their freedom, but also the act of Robespierre and his fellow Jacobins, that it mediates and returns to the French people in a different and purer form. For James, this has nothing to do with idealizing Robespierre or giving him the credit for the French, and in particular the Haitian, revolutions. Indeed, immediately following the passage I've just read, he notes dryly that Robespierre was not present at the session and did not approve of the step. Despite his indispensable founding role, Robespierre in James's reading remains very much circumscribed and limited by his own goals, unable to imagine or appreciate a truly universal emancipation, despite his personal and political opposition to slavery. In other words, he allows tactical and programmatic concerns to stand in the way of a true act. In naming the Haitian slaves Black Jacobins, however, James also attributes a kind of primacy to the Jacobin impulse and implies that something more is transmitted by Robespierre and his comrades than they themselves were able to act upon or even to articulate as an aim or an ideal. As in Freud's reading of Moses, this is not a matter of emulation or imitation, therefore, but of being struck by an act whose implications exceed the framework of a political program or set of ideals, that does not pass through the ties of identification that bind the members of the group to their leader and to one another. The doctrine of emancipation does not really arise from the French people themselves. As Arendt rightly observes, the revolutionary program of the Jacobins is neither of nor by the people, but at most for it. Instead, it passes from the intellectuals of the Jacobin Club to the Haitian slaves and back to the French people, who then assume it in an act that constitutes them as a people and as the true agents and actors of the French Revolution, but a full 4 years after its beginning. In other words, Robespierre's own message is returned to him in an inverted form, mediated by this incredible relay from Paris to the colonies and back to the people of Paris, before returning to Robespierre in a form that he is unable to disavow any longer. This example shows that the people thus constituted, if we take this to name the poor French masses in particular, is in no way constituted by shared interests, a common history, or geographical proximity, or for that matter even numerical superiority, but by the acts of rebel slaves laying claim to equality, men and women who at this juncture in history can lay no claim to belonging to that people and who indeed find themselves excluded from membership not only in its political community but in its idea of the human.